final segment of our program is another experiment in continuing education. I met with Dr. Robert Carlson, the longstanding chair of the NCCN Breast Cancer Guidelines Committee. I like to kid Bob that he's the king of the breast cancer evidence base, and for this interview, I wanted to get his take on a recent survey we conducted of 12 clinical investigators who attended a think tank debating some of the major controversies in the field. I had invited Dr. Carlson to this meeting, but he was unavailable, and I was particularly interested in his viewpoints on these much-debated topics coming out of his experience with the strict demands for supporting evidence in the NCCN guidelines process. The think tank faculty answers to this survey are reproduced in the book accompanying this program. And to begin, I asked Dr. Carlson to comment on this statement that most of the faculty supported. Postmenopausal patients with node-negative, strongly ER and PR HER2-negative tumors between 1 and 2 centimeters should be started on an aromatase inhibitor as opposed to tamoxifen for 2 years followed by an aromatase inhibitor.
The studies that we have looking at the different methods of using aromatase inhibitors or incorporating them, initial aromatase inhibitor therapy versus sequential with tamoxifen after 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen versus extended after 5 years. You know, the strategies have never truly been studied in a randomized fashion, one against another. The big 198 trial will give us the first look at that sort of comparison. The question really is there really something that tamoxifen is doing to prime the breast cancer cells that then makes the aromatase inhibitor more effective? Or is it rather that the population of women and the characteristics of their breast cancer specifically, whether that changes over time in a way we would expect to make the aromatase inhibitors or any hormonal therapy more effective? And I actually think that there is a substantial amount of data that would support the selection bias theory that the population of breast cancers over time is changing. You would expect the endocrine-resistant receptor-positive breast cancers to recur earlier. And so those women are removed from the denominator. So if you do really have a sensitive population and an insensitive population of hormone receptor positive tumors, you should expect, even if there's no difference in efficacy between the hormonal therapies, you should expect to see an increasing effect the later in time you initiate the therapy. I think it's very hard to have a drug that's so effective down the road that you catch up with a loss of 2 to 3 absolute percentage points of women in this context.
So if you were to see 100 women, what would be the likely prescription they walk out with?
I think the vast majority would walk out with a prescription for an aromatase inhibitor, typically anastrozole in my practice.
So I think, in effect, even though you are disclaiming this by saying, you know, in a way we don't really have the pure scientific NCCN answer, your practice says something else.
Yes. We have to establish some sort of practice pattern ourselves so that we don't confuse ourselves and our clinic system and nurses and pharmacy have some expectation about what to expect. And my practice pattern is to lead with an AI. It is interesting how different expert panels and expert groups interpreted over time differently the emerging aromatase inhibitor data. As you know, the NCCN panel within about, I think it was 10 to 14 days of the initial ATAC presentation had modified the guideline to allow initial anastrozole as an option to tamoxifen in postmenopausal women as a hormonal therapy. The ASCO panel felt that tamoxifen should remain the standard hormonal therapy initially. But that guideline over time has also changed, and now actually the NCCN and the ASCO guidelines are almost essentially identical in terms of that. The St. Gallen guideline, which is revised on a less frequent basis, now allows the utilization of an aromatase inhibitor in the therapy of adjuvant postmenopausal receptor-positive breast cancer, but still considers tamoxifen an equivalent recommendation. I don't know how to respond to that because that is not consistent with my interpretation of the data.
It really is interesting, this sort of U.S., non-U.S., or European split on this. Here's the next one we threw out to the group. HER2 and PR status should not currently be used to select adjuvant endocrine therapy.
I would agree.
That's the most common answer, but only 6 out of 12.
But I would agree with it because the reasons that you would look at PR and the reasons you would look at HER2 are because there is some evidence that overexpression of HER2 creates relative tamoxifen resistance or relative aromatase inhibitor sensitivity. and that tumors that are ER positive and PR negative may be particularly sensitive to anastrozole in the adjuvant setting. But because I would use an aromatase inhibitor initially as a standard, while they may be important factors, I'm already selecting the therapy that they would point to.
Right. So either way, you're using it regardless of HER2 and PR status. And I guess the one thing we don't know yet, I don't think, is like what happens once you throw trastuzumab in there.
We don't. That's correct.
Okay, so here's the next statement. Premenopausal patients age 40 to 45 with ER-positive, node-positive tumors who cease menstruation with chemotherapy should be treated with tamoxifen for 2 years, and then, if still amenorrheic and chemically postmenopausal, switch to an AI.
I personally would neither agree nor disagree with that statement. I would feel certainly comfortable switching such a woman to an aromatase inhibitor based upon the trial data that we have. The difficulty with that statement, of course, is that the crossover trials, the switching trials, did not include such women in their trials. The
right.
Women had to be postmenopausal at the time of diagnosis. And so some of it is an issue of how biologically similar do we think women are who have gone through menopause with chemotherapy, presumably, and remain postmenopausal. How similar are those women to women who are just postmenopausal at the time they're diagnosed?
Is that a strategy that you utilize?
It is a strategy that I have utilized.
Is it generally what you do?
I tend more commonly in that situation to administer a full 5 years of tamoxifen and then cross over to letrozole as the MA17 trial. The MA17 trial eligibility criteria did allow women who would become
right.
postmenopausal
right.
during the 5 years of tamoxifen.
Yeah, there's that old evidence-based thing coming back to haunt you. But what about a patient with 10 positive nodes? Still going to keep the tamoxifen going for 5 years?
You know, I guess the higher the risk for recurrence, the more willing I would be to consider crossover to an aromatase inhibitor earlier. But that's not necessarily logical because my confidence doesn't increase in that situation that
right.
my decision is correct.
Obviously, the concern is the woman going to start menstruating again and then you're going to have an ineffective therapy? And the other option is at some point, even at the beginning, to include LHRH agonist, you know, removal of the ovaries, even if the woman has stopped menstruating, just to be sure.
That's correct, and that is certainly an option. The important point, though, that you're raising indirectly is that in the woman who you believe has become postmenopausal, secondary to adjuvant chemotherapy, many of those women will have resumption of ovarian function. And
right.
so in that
right.
context, if you're going to use an aromatase inhibitor, you really need to be confident that the woman not only is postmenopausal when you start it, but that they remain so as it's continued.
I say this is the number one issue and question about endocrine therapy that you hear from community-based oncologists. Tremendous concern about this, I think justifiably.
It's an important issue. The aromatase inhibitors don't work in women with functioning ovaries.
Well, that leads to the other issue, which is the question of the woman who continues menstruation after chemotherapy. And the question that I posed to the group, which was based on the fact that I know that in clinical practice, there are a substantial minority of oncologists who use this strategy, but you know, maybe 20-30% who will do this. And here's the statement. Premenopausal patients with ER-positive, node-positive tumors who continue menstruating after chemotherapy should be offered, in addition to other options, and others presented as one of the options initially, ovarian suppression ablation plus an AI.
I would disagree.
Yeah, and most people disagreed, and actually nobody flat out agreed with that. And it's interesting because people do that. Obviously, there are trials out there. What's your thought about why you think it's not something that should be done?
None of the aromatase inhibitor trials that have been reported have enrolled women who were rendered postmenopausal by the treating oncologist. And so it's a population of women that do not meet or I think come close to the eligibility criteria for the aromatase inhibitor trials. Now, my expectation is that such a strategy is going to be highly effective. If we look at the studies that have looked at ovarian suppression and aromatase inhibition in metastatic postmenopausal breast cancer with positive hormone receptors.
Like yours.
Yeah, like the trial that we're doing at Stanford with MD Anderson. The clinical benefit rate is very high. It's in the 80% range.
Can you talk more about the numbers of patients and where you're at right now with that, incidentally?
We have 29 patients out of a planned 30 enrolled. It's a study designed for premenopausal women with hormone receptor positive measurable metastatic breast cancer who have not received prior aromatase inhibitor. And it's a straight phase 2 trial, and we're seeing quite surprisingly high rates of clinical benefit and very long durations of disease control.
Can you talk more about the numbers?
The clinical benefit rate is about 75% to 80%. The time to progression is well beyond 6 months. One of our early patients that was enrolled in trial is still in a clinical complete response at 4.5 years.
Wow. Where was the disease?
She had disease in bone and in pleura and lung.
And she's still on this therapy?
Yes.
4.5 years later in complete remission?
Yes. And she actually presented with hypercalcemia.
Wow.
And was quite ill. Had a performance status of probably 60 to 70% and declining. And
how old was she?
She is in her mid-40s.
And so she got this therapy without chemo?
She got this therapy without chemotherapy.
Wow. A lot of people would have given her chemo.
And that's the recommendation that she came to us with.
Wow. You treated her?
Yes. And she's now 4.5 years down the road.
With her hair?
Working full-time with beautiful, long, black
wow.
hair. Actually, I saw her just recently. She swam 128 miles last month.
128 miles. Wow. And what have you seen in her and the other women in terms of how they tolerated this drastic reduction in estrogen levels?
Most of them tolerate it remarkably well.
Really?
They do have hot flashes that do improve with time. And of some interest, and I don't know exactly what to make of it, but the arthralgia syndrome that we see with the aromatase inhibitors does not appear to be as frequent.
Wow, interesting. Although it didn't seem to be that much on our radar in the metastatic setting to start with. Do you agree?
I agree. And I had initially attributed that to the fact that in the metastatic setting, the women just weren't being treated
right.
for that long a duration.
Lost.
But even in our phase 2 trial, where the women actually are staying on study for substantial lengths of time, we're just not seeing the severity of the arthralgias that we do in the adjuvant setting.
As long as we're talking about hormonal therapy, let me throw a few issues that we threw out to them about hormonal therapy in the metastatic disease setting. Here's the statement. One acceptable non-protocol option for a patient with an ER-positive tumor who develops progressive metastatic disease on an AI is to continue the AI and add in fulvestrant.
I would disagree.
Why do you feel this shouldn't be done?
Well, I would recommend against it. Primarily because we don't have good clinical trial evidence that shows a benefit to the strategy. There are some early phase 2 trials that have looked at the combination, so I think we have some confidence about its safety profile, and it would be reasonably safe. But we just don't have good efficacy data.
Of course, this is being tested in clinical trials, and hopefully we're going to have an answer pretty soon. I know the SOFIA trial is probably going to be one of the first, although I think there's some others. What do you think those studies are going to show, since we're in that thing of predicting trials again? So dangerous, huh?
My expectation would be that the combination would be no better than either one of the individual therapies.
Really? Interesting. In a non-protocol setting, a loading dose of fulvestrant should generally be utilized.
I agree.
So that is something you do in your practice?
Yes, it is.
And again, we're seeing a lot of that, both in investigators as well as oncs in practice. Where do you think things are heading with fulvestrant in terms of dose and schedule and use in premenopausal women? You get back to this issue, should you make the woman postmenopausal? What do you think about all that?
Well, I continue to see an increase in the amount of patients or the number of patients treated with fulvestrant, and I think that that's very reasonable. I think that experience has confirmed the tolerability of the drug and the efficacy of the therapy. So my expectation is we'll see nothing but that therapy increase. In terms of use in the premenopausal woman, I think in the metastatic setting, we're going to see increasing numbers of patients treated with fulvestrant. In part because I think that the truly limited number of endocrine agents that we have available for the treatment of premenopausal breast cancer really means that functionally, after a premenopausal woman has been treated with tamoxifen, you're really obligated to make her postmenopausal. And once she's postmenopausal, then the whole spectrum of endocrine agents that are effective in the postmenopausal woman become available.
So I guess, in a way, it reminds me a little bit about prostate cancer, where it's sort of like once men with PSA progression or metastatic disease are started on androgen deprivation, they kind of stay on it indefinitely, it seems like.
Right.
So in a way, this is a similar strategy. So have you used, or do you have patients who are an LHRH agonist plus fulvestrant?
Yes, I do. In the metastatic setting.
Right.
And in that context, I do have some women that are in that setting, but that's also a setting because my expectation is that the women will be on hormone therapy for some length of time. Those are often also women who I would send to the gynecologic oncologist for a laparoscopic oophorectomy.
What do we know about the issue? This is another question I hear from oncologists and researchers talking about how effective LHRH agonists of varying types and durations or interval uses actually effectively suppress ovarian function. Some people question whether or not they can depend on LHRH agonists.
There are several parts to that question. One is that some of the LHRH agonists and formulations don't adequately suppress ovarian function. And so, for instance, gesserolin, which is, to my understanding, the only FDA-approved LHRH agonist against breast cancer in the United States, the formulation that's approved is the monthly gesserolin injection. The every 3-monthly gesserolin injections do not, for breast cancer purposes, adequately suppress ovarian estrogen synthesis. So there's breakthrough towards the end of the 3 months with every 3-monthly formulations.
So what do you use in your trial?
Monthly gesserolin injections.
And have you had any breakthrough menstruation or any indication that this doesn't work?
We actually measure serum estrogen levels in our trial, and there was a single patient who had a bump in her estradiol level to back into the premenopausal range. It subsequently went back down to the postmenopausal range. We've tried to figure out what it was about.
Just happened once in one patient?
It's happened once in a single patient.
Out of 29?
Out of 29. And we tried to identify what caused it. Was her gesserolin injection late? Was there something else going on? And we were not able to identify anything that would have expected to have caused that.
And when did you do the measurements?
We did them at baseline, at 3 months, at 6 months.
But when with regard to the injection?
It would have been on the day of injection.
So it should have been at the lowest point.
Yes.
That's pretty encouraging. One measurement out of 29 patients suggests that it works.
Oh, yes.
That's good.
That's very good.
That's good to know. We haven't asked the patterns of care. We should find out what kind of LHRH agonist people are using. What do you think? And how often?
My expectation would be that with gesserolin, in those that are using gesserolin, you'll probably find that 70 to 80% are using the monthly injections, and the others are using the every 3-monthly injections. And I think we'd also find a substantial number of oncologists using leuprolide.
What do we know about leuprolide and breast cancer? I mean, you mentioned the FDA thing, but what about clinical research data?
Well, the clinical research data that's available and published would suggest that leuprolide does adequately suppress ovarian estrogen synthesis as well. There's just not quite as much data as there is with gesserolin.
Okay. So here's a simple one. In patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative tumors under a sonometer, the Oncotype DX assay should be offered, and patients with high recurrence scores should be offered chemotherapy plus endocrine therapy.
I think that I would be in between in that. The Oncotype DX assay has very encouraging data behind it. It's a well thought out clinical test. I personally don't believe yet that we have enough data, and the lack of prospective data concerns me to be confident that it really is better than a well-educated physician looking at, for instance, the estimates from Adjuvant Online and then modifying them based upon level of estrogen receptor, level of HER2 overexpression, and so forth. The NCCN guideline does not incorporate the Oncotype DX assay in the guideline itself. It is acknowledged in a footnote in the guideline that there are genetic-based tests, including Oncotype DX as one of them, that have promising early results but are not yet appropriate for full incorporation into decision-making.
You know, I guess the question is, you're sitting across from an educated patient who's been out on the internet and knows about this test and has read all the papers and stuff and says to you, well, would this be something that would be a factor that would be helpful in making this difficult decision? I have a 1.5 centimeter tumor or 0.8 centimeter, you know, node negative tumor. I don't want to have to go through chemotherapy if I don't really need it.
Sure. The patient who comes in requesting the Oncotype DX assay, who has the financial resources or a third-party payer who's going to cover the cost of the test, I have no issue with ordering the test.
And actually, as it turns out, your take on this represents the most common answer we got, which was 6 of the 12 were in between. However, there are few on each side.
Well, I think it's going to take more confirmatory data. And I also wonder whether we aren't, again, learning from the Oncotype DX assay itself the importance of quantitative determinations of estrogen receptor, HER2 expression, and so forth, and that the incorporation of quantitative ER and PR and HER2 in our prognostic models, such as Adjuvant Online, or simply our mental models of prognosis, may in fact give us more accurate estimates of outcome, especially benefits from therapy, than we have had previously, even in the absence of using the Oncotype DX assay itself.
Okay, here's the next one we threw out to the group, and this was based upon Steve Jones' interesting presentation of his U.S. oncology trial at San Antonio comparing docetaxel cyclophosphamide to doxorubicin cyclophosphamide. And let me throw the question out to you. Docetaxel cyclophosphamide is generally a preferable regimen to AC.
I would disagree.
Disagree, okay. It was virtually split. You know, it was 3, 4, and 5. So there were several people who agreed, several people who disagreed, several people who were in between. What was your take on those data and other data looking at similar questions, and what does the NCCN have to say about it?
Well, the NCCN panel hasn't met since Steve's presentation, and so we haven't addressed that trial specifically. My own take on the data is that we have Lori Goldstein's AC versus AT trial using paclitaxel that did not show an advantage to paclitaxel. We have E1199 that Joe Sperano presented at San Antonio as well that didn't show major differences in efficacy between paclitaxel and docetaxel, whether they were given every 3 weekly or weekly. And so Steve's data really sort of stands out alone in showing superiority of docetaxel over paclitaxel in the indirect comparison. So I want to see more data. I want to see more experience with the regimen before I would be willing to agree that it is clearly superior. I also have a lot of concerns about docetaxel's toxicity. It does have a different toxicity profile than paclitaxel, different toxicity profile than doxorubicin. At doses that are typically used, there's a fairly high frequency of fever neutropenia if growth factor support isn't used. It has a significant amount of fatigue associated with it.
You participated in one of the 3 breast cancer town meetings that we did. One of the things that was very interesting was we asked them to rate their aversion to different side effects and toxicities in the adjuvant setting, things like hair loss, fatigue. And one of the interesting things was the tremendous aversion we saw to the low but definite risk of cardiomyopathy with something like AC. As minimal as it was, and you know the numbers we're going through, that was one of the highest rated adverse issues. It reminded me a little bit of endometrial cancer and tamoxifen. They did not like that. So you wonder again how patients might perceive the possibility of going without an anthracycline.
Well, I think that cardiomyopathy is a great concern for a number of patients, and I think it's an appropriate concern given the fact that especially anthracycline cardiomyopathy does not improve. You can treat it often, but its natural history is that the myocardium does not improve. So it's a very legitimate concern. And so some of the issue, of course, is whether you're worried a great deal about an uncommon but very serious event versus a more transient but much more common event, such as fatigue. It's a tough one. I think physicians are also biased by what they see. We see the patients coming back after each cycle of chemotherapy, and we see the acute toxicities. Oncologists don't necessarily quite so frequently see the chronic toxicities for the patients that are out 5 and 10 years.
There were a few sort of related taxane questions I thought I'd throw out at you at this point, and it really gets into the question of the 3 available taxanes, how you view them and how the NCCN views them. I guess cost and reimbursement issues aside, if an oncologist elects to use adjuvant AC followed by docetaxel, the dose of docetaxel should be 100 per meter squared and preemptive Q3 weeks, obviously, and preemptive myeloid growth factor should be utilized.
Well, I think that docetaxel given every 3 weeks at 100 per meter squared is a reasonable taxane to use following AC chemotherapy. So I have no difficulty with that. E1199 suggested equal efficacy with paclitaxel in that setting. Although, again, perhaps a little bit more toxicity, especially fever neutropenia, to my recollection, with the every 3 weekly regimen. And given the increased frequency of fever neutropenia, I do think that growth factors would be very reasonable to use in that dose and schedule.
So 6 agreed, 3 in between, 3 disagree. And again, Gary Lyman told me that there's a surprising lack of preemptive growth factors. And he does these patterns of care kinds of things, particularly when TAC is used, which I thought was like, everybody knows if you use TAC, you got to give growth factors. According to him, there's significant numbers of patients being treated with adjuvant TAC without growth factors. Any take on what's going on?
I don't understand that. TAC certainly causes fever and neutropenia with high enough frequency that growth factors should be used. And actually, the NCCN breast cancer treatment guideline does specify doses and schedules of chemotherapy regimens. And in the situation with TAC, the NCCN breast cancer treatment guideline does specify dose and schedule and specifies the use of growth factors in two of the adjuvant chemotherapy regimens. One would be TAC, and the other would be the dose-dense chemotherapy regimens.
All right. Again, in the realm of adjuvant chemotherapy, patients with strongly ERPR-positive, node-positive tumors should generally receive TAC chemotherapy as opposed to dose-dense AC paclitaxel and other regimens. Getting into this question of to what extent was benefit seen with dose-dense, are we as confident in that in an ER-positive patient as we are with TAC?
One of the difficulties in looking at the adjuvant therapy studies and making cross-study comparisons, I think, are that the patient populations are often quite different. The doses and schedules of chemotherapy are almost by definition different. And I think it is provocative, the analysis that's been done of the dose-dense study that shows very little benefit to dose-densing the therapy in receptor-positive breast cancer versus the analysis in the TAC study where there doesn't appear to be much difference in efficacy between the ER-negative and the ER-positive patients favoring TAC. But those are indirect comparisons, and so I'm not sure that we can make much of that specific finding in that study. It'll be interesting to see as E1199 folds out to see with very mature data to see if there is a differential responsiveness with docetaxel versus paclitaxel, because that's what you'd have to hypothesize here.
Based on ER?
Based on ER, that's correct.
Actually, most of the people there agreed with you and felt like they weren't ready to abandon dose-dense AC paclitaxel, which according to our patterns of care studies in both investigators as well as an oncologist, is by far the most common chemotherapeutic regimen right now being used for node-positive patients. And as far as I know, last time I talked to you, that was your sort of chosen regimen for node-positive patients. Is that the case?
Yes, and it continues to be the case. I've been surprised at how non-toxic dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel is to deliver. I think you can argue it's even less toxic and easier to deliver than the every 3 weekly regimens. And my experience with TAC is that it's a difficult regimen. It's a tolerable regimen. Women can get through it, but it's a much more difficult regimen just in terms of acute toxicities.
I hear more people talking about dose-dense AC just as being more convenient for the patient, more reliable to get in. It's being looked at in a study. Do you think that Q2-week with growth factor AC times 4 is a reasonable regimen? Is it something that you utilize?
I think it's a reasonable regimen, and it is something that I utilize in the patients for whom I do not think a taxane is necessary. It's based upon the belief, and it's a belief, it's not yet proven, that if dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel or the ATC dose-dense regimen is superior, that it's likely that every 2 weekly AC should be superior or at least equal to every 3 weekly AC. And again, I'm impressed with when you use growth factors, how non-toxic it is. And women, I think, like to get through these therapies quickly. And you certainly shorten the duration of treatment with the dose-dense regimens.
I've heard people say, but yeah, you're talking about 4 cycles of AC. You're really just making it shorter by a few weeks.
I guess how important a few weeks is may be relative, but the patients going through the chemotherapy, it must seem like an awfully long time to them.
Yep. Alopecia, also be nice to kind of get that over with quicker. Here's a question that just occurred to me this morning, so I didn't ask it to the group, but I'm curious to know what you would say. For patients with minimally symptomatic metastatic breast cancer in non-visceral sites, the optimal first-line chemotherapy regimen is single-agent capecitabine.
I would agree with that.
Without bevacizumab?
Yes.
Interesting. Is that your clinical practice?
Yes.
How much is that related to the lack of reimbursement and FDA indication of bevacizumab versus clinical science?
It's not based upon reimbursement issues. I actually have been surprised that I have not had bevacizumab denied to any of the patients to whom I've recommended it. I have sometimes had to step up to the plate and fight for them, but I've never had it denied to date.
We see a lot more use of capecitabine in metastatic disease and really earlier use in clinical investigators, breast cancer specialists than in community practice. Big difference. Investigators like capecitabine. They use it a lot more than people in practice. The people in practice bring up reimbursement and cost issues to the patients as one thing that kind of gets in their way a little bit. But I think it really goes beyond that and just the perception of the agent. Are you saying in general that capecitabine is your first-line chemotherapeutic agent?
Yes.
What's your thinking in that regard?
Well, I think that capecitabine has efficacy that is in the ballpark of any single agent. And I tend to treat metastatic breast cancer that's not in visceral crisis with single-agent therapy. And the toxicity profile of capecitabine is very favorable. The women appreciate being able to take an oral medication, not having to go to the infusion center, not having to come back frequently. And it's an agent that doses that are typically used has very predictable toxicity experience.
What dose do you use?
I use 1,000 milligrams per meter squared twice daily.
2 weeks out of three and see what happens.
2 out of 3. And
that's 80% of oncologists in the United States. Where does the issue of alopecia in the metastatic setting come in from your perspective in terms of the fact that capecitabine generally doesn't cause that?
Well, I think that that's very important. And if you're going to use sequential single agents, it's always nice to start with a single agent that doesn't cause alopecia. Because if the woman already has established alopecia and you initiate that agent, you don't really gain from the non-alopecia properties of the therapy in a woman who's already lost her hair. And that's often a very important component, I think, of treatment of metastatic disease. The other reason that I often will lead with capecitabine is that many of these women, because it's the first-line therapy for metastatic disease, have recently been diagnosed with their metastasis. They're going through all the turmoil and psychic trauma of the new diagnosis. And in that context, I think it often is nice to start with an agent that has really acceptable toxicity, where they don't lose their hair and so forth, so that they can become used to the chronic nature of the disease, the need for ongoing chemotherapy, with an agent that has good efficacy and doesn't negatively impact their quality of life to a major degree.
What kind of patients have you used bevacizumab in?
I have utilized it primarily for first line, in one patient as second line chemotherapy for metastatic disease in combination with paclitaxel.
So a la ECOG 2100, same eligibility, checked out their brains first?
Yes.
What are your thoughts when you think through that in terms of age and prior arterial events or thrombotic events?
In general, I think bevacizumab is a well-tolerated agent. And so in a woman who I think is going to be able to tolerate paclitaxel, I would expect her to be able to tolerate the combination. I haven't had any patients in whom I've considered the agent who have had either arterial or venous thrombotic events. Those events are pretty uncommon, however.
If you had a patient like that, how would you think it through?
I probably would not use the agent based upon the limited experience that we have.
If it happened 5 years ago or 10 years ago, would the time since the event have a big impact on you?
I think it would depend upon what the event was.
Right.
And whether there was a precipitating event for the thrombosis or not.
How about age?
I haven't considered age as an independent factor. If I think the woman is physiologically able to handle a taxane, then I would expect her to be able to handle the addition of bevacizumab.
In your own practice, when you are about to utilize chemotherapy in the metastatic setting for the first time, which might be way down the line if they've had a lot of hormones, for example, what fraction of those women roughly are either minimally symptomatic, asymptomatic, not visceral crisis, or a lot of visceral disease?
Well, I think the vast majority of them are minimally symptomatic. It's uncommon today for me to see a woman who's truly in visceral crisis, where combination chemotherapy is, you know, the way to go. In a woman who does have visceral involvement that I'm concerned about, that's the patient population now where I would often start with paclitaxel and bevacizumab as opposed to capecitabine. The way I tell the patients is that there's a series of agents that we're going to use. You're going to probably see most, if not all of them, through the course of your illness. And the sequence in which we use them is probably less important than the agent. If we have a situation where agents look like they're equally efficacious, we will use the ones that have the least toxicity.
Why do you think it is that clinical investigators are using more capecitabine than oncs in practice?
I suspect that a lot of it may be financially driven. most of the clinical investigators that you're talking about are academicians, where the infusion center and the revenue from that is separated from them. They're buffered from that. I suspect that that influences decision making.
Interesting. Here's another question we threw out to the group. Patients with ER, PR, HER2 negative tumors, triple negative, should be offered bevacizumab plus chemotherapy in the first line metastatic setting.
Well, I think it's reasonable to offer such a patient chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. The best evidence we have is, of course, with paclitaxel bevacizumab. And Kathy Miller has the other ECOG study that looked at capecitabine with or without bevacizumab that showed slightly higher response rate with the combination, but no advantage in terms of relapse-free survival and overall survival. So we may be seeing specific drug effects or drug interactions between bevacizumab and chemotherapy. It may be different patient populations. The capecitabine patients were patients being treated in the second-line setting, not the first-line setting as with paclitaxel plus bevacizumab.
And of course, Kathy, we're really, George Sledge is looking at a study right now, first-line capecitabine plus bevacizumab.
And I think that that's an important question. But based upon the existing data that we have looking at capecitabine bevacizumab and showing little advantage to that, I'm not combining bevacizumab and capecitabine. We don't see an advantage, and bevacizumab, while most patients tolerate it well, does have toxicity and certainly expense. So I'm limiting bevacizumab use at the current time to concurrent with paclitaxel.
About a few Herceptin adjuvant questions. Breast cancers that are HER2 positive should be subjected to assays of TOPO2, and that should be used to select chemotherapy regimens to combine with trastuzumab, specifically whether to include anthracycline.
I would disagree.
And 9 people disagreed, 2 agreed. You know, I know when those data were presented by Dennis Slamon, and Dan Hayes actually was one of the leaders of that session, and he was saying, I don't think we're ready to go. These people said it, you said it, but you know, those data look pretty impressive.
But how many times have we seen prognostic and predictive factors that in single studies looked very impressive, but when they were tested more broadly, were found not to be nearly as impressive prognosticators or predictors? So I think we need more experience. It certainly looks like a very promising clue that TOPO2 expression may be important, but we need a bigger data set. We need a validation set.
Do you think that simply completing the BCIRG data, in other words, I think they reported 2,000 patients, they're going to do the rest of them and have a little more mature data pretty soon, is going to be enough? Would it have to be another trial, and is there another trial?
I think I'd have to see what the data looked like, what the magnitude of benefit was, how consistent it was, and so forth, before I would be able to really answer that question. I think it's possible the BCIRG trial alone will be adequate to answer the question, but it's going to depend upon how impressive the data looks.
Patients with HER2-positive, node-negative breast cancers that are less than a centimeter should generally receive adjuvant trastuzumab chemotherapy as part of their treatment plan. 6 disagreed, 6 were in between.
When you get to such small tumors, you then get to a situation where the expected benefit then gets into the range of the risk of significant cardiac toxicity. So my practice pattern has been not to offer Herceptin to women whose tumors were less than 1 centimeter in size.
Just a sort of a side note to that issue, the cardiac toxicity, without going into great detail, do you see a role right now of non-protocol TCH?
No, I don't.
Why?
The BCIRG data would suggest that TCH is not better than non-TCH regimens, and there's a suggestion it may be worse. It does appear true that there is substantially less cardiac toxicity, but the efficacy doesn't look nearly as good. So I guess that if I was in a situation where I was greatly concerned about the cardiac toxicity, I would probably go with one of the established AC followed by T regimens and then consider an abbreviated course of trastuzumab a la the FIN-HER trial.
Okay. Patients with HER2-positive node-negative breast cancers that are 1 to 2 centimeters should generally receive adjuvant trastuzumab chemotherapy as part of their treatment plan.
I would agree with that.
10 out of 12 agreed. So it's interesting how the numbers sort of triggered people's reaction. I'm just going to kind of go through the last few things. Adjuvant trastuzumab should generally be used concurrently with chemotherapy rather than sequentially.
Would agree with that.
10 people agreed with that, although 2 were in between. Trastuzumab monotherapy is a reasonable non-protocol option in patients who are unfit to receive chemotherapy.
Uncertain.
Yeah, that was one of those 4, 5, and 3 answers. So a few people agreed, a few disagreed, some were uncertain. Is that a strategy you've used?
No, I haven't used it, in part because the trastuzumab data is relatively new, and I had not used trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting prior to the ASCO reports. And patients who are unfit for the use of an anthracycline, a taxane, which is typically what I would use here, I would have a great deal of concern about the cardiac toxicity of the trastuzumab, even as a single agent.
Final question, and this is another one of those 4, 3, and 5 answers I'll just tell you in advance that I love so much. Dose stents, AC paclitaxel trastuzumab, is a reasonable non-protocol adjuvant option in patients with HER2-positive disease.
I agree.
Is that something you're doing?
My standard trastuzumab-containing regimen is dose stents plus trastuzumab, with the trastuzumab started with the paclitaxel. And I was greatly relieved and reassured to see the abstract at San Antonio from the Memorial Sloan Kettering group that was specifically assessing the cardiac toxicity of that. And I think it was 70 or 72 patients enrolled. They had not seen concerning cardiac toxicity. So it looks like that's a reasonable strategy.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.